Hello, my name is Fiona Bond and you're listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU. On this programme, we sit down with creative leaders and artistic innovators in our city. Today we're talking to Tom Bulk, who is Senior Park Planner at City of Waco Parks and Recreation Department, and Robbie Barber, Associate Professor of Sculpture at Baylor University. And we're talking about the Waco Sculpture Zoo, which is currently being installed along the banks of the Brazos River between downtown and Pecan Bottoms. First, I'm joined by Luann Jennings, who heads up Creative Waco's professional development program, which helps artists and creatives figure out how to carve out an income from their creative superpowers. Luann was just recognized by the USA's leading foundation for professional development in the arts, the Emily Hall Tremaine Foundation. And that means she's being funded by them for the next 2 years to work with artists who want to build their business skills in Waco. Luann, welcome to Conversations with Creative Waco.
Hi, thanks, Fiona.
Tell us a little bit about why it's important for artists, performers, and other creative professionals to learn business skills.
I have seen many times that artists who are not able to earn money through their creative work end up quitting, almost always, because it costs money to do this. We have materials we have to pay for. Art is not free. We have materials. Our time is valuable. The people that I've seen who have ended up leaving the creative area entirely are generally the people who are not making any money or who are not making enough to make it worthwhile. They don't teach us how to make money at what we do in drama school and art school and dance school. We have to learn that on our own after we get into the marketplace.
Well, and often that's the hard way, right?
Right. Yes, right. And unfortunately, I've seen many people not able to make that transition. Artists can actually be really good business people because we're extremely disciplined, we're extremely dedicated, and we learn new things well.
And creative and innovative about how to make money.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we have a myth in our heads, and I think a lot of it comes from other people telling us this, that we're incapable of thinking like a business person. And that's just not true. That what I've seen is that artists who approach it in a way that is holistic, that says my creative work and my ability to sell my work are married, they're the same thing, mm-hmm. they work together, are able to make that leap and keep doing it. Other people have said, you know what, it's just not worth it to me. I'd rather just keep on making work and not worry about selling it and have it stay a hobby. That's great. I just don't know too many people who have stuck with it over the years if they weren't able to figure out how to mm-hmm. make it pay for itself at least.
So for artists and creatives who are listening to this going, yes, that's exactly the boost that I need. I really need to figure out how to do marketing, how to monetize what I do. What kind of program are you offering? What can they plug into?
For the last 2 years, we've been offering a class through Creative Waco called The Work of Artists, which just helps artists going with some very basic ideas about business and entrepreneurship, marketing, and money management. This spring, we're launching a new program called The Greenhouse, which will take that one step further and add on to the courses, coaching, mentoring, and potentially funding.
So that's potential seed funding for new initiatives?
Yes, that's right.
Wonderful. So if someone is listening and says, I need this, or I know someone who's going to need this, how can they get plugged into this?
They can get information on our website at creativewaco.org/greenhouse, or they can contact me directly at Luann, Luann, at creativewaco.org.
Thank you so much, Luann. And we will make sure that we put that information on the blog post that goes out with this program. I'm really excited about what this means for creatives in our community and keeping talent and growing talent in our community. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Fiona. Good to be here.
Now we've got a segment from David Smith called David and Art.
I'm sure you've noticed that Christmas is the only holiday that has its own complete roster of music, of songs that accompany it each year, like the Christmas decorations themselves that we pull down out of the attic. Songs that are in turn beautiful, thoughtful, comedic, cliched, delightful, tiresome, and inspiring. Why is this? Why does Christmas have a set of songs that goes with it? Well, one of the roots of this curiosity has to be its religious component. For many people, Christmas is a religious holiday, and music has been a part of religious ceremonies for a very, very long time. But not always. Historian Stephen Nissenbaum points out that while early Puritans actually eliminated the celebration of Christmas, after 1762, every single Congregationalist hymn published in New England included at least one Christmas hymn, although at first these were text only. For the first half of the century, none of the religious music books that were published, what were referred to then as tune books, contained any mention of Christmas. The 1760s, however, brought us closer to what we think of as Christmas songs, that is, words and melodies that were specifically connected, as no less than 9 of them were published that celebrated the Nativity. In the following decade, the one that brings us the American Revolution, composers in New England began writing their own Christmas music, independent from all the earlier ones imported from the old country. Interestingly enough, there was, long before this, a tradition at Christmas that was a little like trick-or-treat at Halloween and involved groups of people going around imposing themselves upon the well-to-do and singing popular songs in exchange for food and drink, usually beer. So, in a sense, there was caroling before there were Christmas songs. The new nativity songs were just grafted onto this tradition. What does all this say about our relationship to art? Well, for one, it's an example of a power that we regularly overlook in art, its ability to affect our attitudes and our moods. Christmas songs put us in the Christmas mood because art is powerful, whether it's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing the Hallelujah Chorus or George Strait singing When It's Christmas Time in Texas. From Handel to Count Basie, Lawrence Welk to Willie Nelson, artists of all kinds have written and or recorded music that we associate with Christmas. Today, the cynical side of us says, oh, they're just doing it to make a buck. And yes, Christmas albums do make a buck or two, but they also contribute to the relationship between art and our ability to celebrate the holiday amidst our relentlessly busy lives.
You are listening to KWBU, and I'm your host for today for Conversations with Creative Waco, Fiona Bond. Today we're talking to Tom Bulk, who is Senior Park Planner at City of Waco Parks Department, and Robbie Barber, who is Associate Professor of Sculpture at Baylor University. And we're going to be talking about the Waco Sculpture Zoo, which is currently being installed along the banks of the Brazos River between downtown and Pecan Bottoms. And so people might well have noticed this series of concrete bases being poured in. And hopefully by the time this goes out, I'm hoping very much that it will have some sculptures there ready for people to see. Tom, tell us a little bit about... yourself, how did you become a park planner, and what on earth does that mean? What do you do for our city?
What on earth does that mean? That's yes. A good question. My background is actually landscape architecture, which is a requirement of the city for the park planner positions.
You're kind of an artist.
Exactly. There's an artistic element to what I do. My background, it very much informs how we approach projects for the city. But I hail from Michigan. I went to Arizona State for school, learned landscape architecture, and then I came here for an apprenticeship opportunity, essentially. I worked under a very passionate mentor, Sharon Fuller. She did great things for this community, including the Cameron Park renovation. So I had a great opportunity to really see the impact of quality design on the community, particularly in the parks lens. And so carrying that forward into the projects we manage now, and more specifically my role as a park planner, a lot of that revolves around contract management. So a more sterile frame than just art.
That's the less arty bit, perhaps?
Correct. But art and elegant design is a fundamental expectation of everything that we bring into it. So regardless of who our partners are, when we hire somebody to design even an engineering project as simple as like a parking lot, we still expect that it's going to meet aesthetic standards and that it's going to fit well on our sites and truly respect the community, the environment, each particular park. So we definitely take that careful craft into every project that we touch. And then it's exciting, it's exceptional when we get to partner on a project like this that is actually art focused. So very relatively uncommon for us so far, but we hope that that's not the case going forward. We look forward to more of these partnership projects.
Well, that's great to hear. And so what I'm hearing from you is you get to do the big picture design for our community.
Absolutely.
And I think we notice when that's done badly in communities, but we probably don't notice so well when it's done really well.
Part of one of the signatures of great design that really fits the landscape that it's within is that it seems so appropriate that it's just comfortable. So it's not a standout element that you always notice and it demands your attention. It's just comfortable and appropriate, and people are able to program it in whatever way they choose.
So those elements of delight and invitation as we go about our public spaces and parks, that's designed in.
Absolutely, yes. Sometimes there are happy accidents, but a great deal of effort is put into trying to make those moments and those signature elements of any place.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about this particular project from that parks and recreation design standpoint. How did it come about? I know from our end at Creative Waco, the project came about partly because there was vision from Clifton and Betsy Robinson, who've been great supporters of major arts and public art projects in this community. And the original plan was a little smaller than it is right now.
Certainly. As many of these things go, I've seen this play out in a number of projects where the initial seed of an idea, it's kind of a tentative attempt to float an initiative out there to say, hey, we could get behind an idea that could be great. And at first, you can only marshal the support that you can marshal, and whether that's the money that's available or the members that are part of your team. But as soon as that good idea gets out there, other people often want to be part of it. And so in the case of this project, it's tremendous to say that it went from being a modest 4 or 5 or 6 piece effort to now we've got 28 sculptures going in along the river.
Okay, so 28 sculptures going in along by the river. That is going to have a big impact.
Very big impact. And it's distributed along about, probably the most popular mile of our Riverwalk system. So they're not all next to each other immediately. So it's a comfortable spacing, but a big impact along an important stretch of our Riverwalk.
So what are the kinds of things you need to think about when you are putting 28 sculptures in along our river that the rest of us may not think about? What gives you heartburn? What are the potential pitfalls?
The potential pitfalls would be placing something in a location that isn't in its best long-term interest. You know, so that can, in the case of a river, of course, you know, you don't want to place something in a situation where it's going to get washed away or fall in. Some of the banks are unstable.
And this is a flood zone, right?
Absolutely. So I think the obligation is on us to anticipate and just assume that at some point these footings, these foundations will be underwater. So what are the necessary design accommodations to make that happen? And then in the case of a sculpture project, you want our footings to be you do not want those to be the main attraction. You want the footings to be somewhat invisible, but doing their very important job, and then allowing us to situate the art in its best aspect and configuration. The other basics for us are just making sure that we leave enough space for the pedestrians to feel comfortable because we are placing it along the Riverwalk. Also anticipating that, you know, we don't want to create a traffic hazard, so we have to stay back from the road a bit. So there are just the fundamental considerations that go into it, but then everything in support of maximizing the aesthetic impact, the experiential impact. And as you know, there was a considerable amount of effort and time dedicated towards revisiting. I don't know how many times you and I walked that corridor to make sure that we had selected appropriate locations for each of the pieces and that the orientation was correct.
And going to set each of those pieces off to their best possible advantage.
Exactly.
That is so interesting. And I know that the very first time we did that walk, you had already thought very deeply about how those could be placed, how each piece could be placed, because this is a huge variety of artistic styles, different sculptors. And we should say each one of those 28 pieces is very different. They represent animals in the zoo, but they're very different treatments of that basic concept. And that's a really good point at which to introduce Robbie. And Robbie, you are one of the artists in this project.
Correct.
And your piece, I'm going to say it's going to be one of the high impact pieces. Do you want to describe the piece that's going into this particular project?
Sure. I actually wanted it to, you know, do my best to have it be as high impact as possible. I chose to make a giraffe, to make a abstracted giraffe. I work in a variety of materials, so I do a lot of welding, a lot of welded steel. So I thought about, you know, which animal activates space best. And so as I thought about things like lions and tigers, I immediately just said, well, they just don't have that visual impact from a distance. And for me, outdoor sculpture should be large in scale. It should have a really strong impact. It should really hit you.
Remind me how tall your piece mm-hmm. is. This will definitely have impact.
Right. It's about 18 and a half feet tall, which it was interesting because I was trying to make it as big as possible, and I actually found out that that's the average height of a giraffe. So it kind of was an accident that I made it life-size.
Who knew? There you go.
Exactly. Because artists can change scale and all like that. So it just seemed to work out perfect for it to be the actual size of a normal giraffe. To me, the giraffe activated space in a way that no other animal in the zoo does. So that was just kind of a no-brainer as far as choosing that.
And I know lots of people have told me how popular the giraffes are. We love seeing them mm-hmm. at the zoo. They're very endearing animals. One of the things I love about this project is I think a lot of the artwork really draws out the aspects of people and of humanity, what we engage with in other people that we also engage with in animals. I think that's one of the really fascinating things about having animals as a subject. But Robbie, how did you become an artist in the first place? Why did you choose that path? And clearly it was, we always joke at Creative Waco, if it's for the money and the glory, you're in the wrong job. So tell us
it's funny.
How you became an artist.
It's funny because as a teacher, whenever I see a student that really is doing really well with sculpture, I kind of go to them and I say, you know, my condolences. I'm sorry to inform you that you're great at this and you're going to have a tough time the rest of your life.
Yeah, so it's going to be a rocky road for you.
Exactly. Well, honestly, I know this might sound a little corny, but I just think I feel like I was meant to do this. And, you know, I remember I'm an advisor for students at Baylor, academic advisor, so I'm always trying to talk to them about why you choose the path that you choose. And I tell them, I said, you just really need to trust your gut. I mean, that's what you need to do. You don't overthink it. Go with what feels right. And so I guess, you know, the best way to answer that is I always felt comfortable. I felt right being in the arts. When I walked into the art building in college, it was like this wave of relief just came over me. So you know, short answer is I just think I was meant to do it. I was born and raised in North Carolina, and, you know, it didn't take me long to learn, you know, to learn how to be an artist. I had to go to school. I got 2 degrees. I went to University of Arizona for graduate school, so we have Arizona tie-in. Undergrad, I went to East Carolina University, which is a really good art school in North Carolina. What happens at some point is, you know, you have to get a real job, so to speak. So it was like, oh, well, maybe I could teach. And when you apply to teaching jobs, you apply to them all over the country, and you don't really know where you're going to wind up. So that's what brought me to Texas, is really just the teaching job. Mm. So here I am. I've been at Baylor for 20 years.
Wow. I didn't realize you'd been here mm-hmm. This long. And I know people can see your work in other places around Waco. You have a piece at the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
And I know you've had several exhibitions in this community as well as further afield.
Right. Yeah, and what that really brings up is, you know, my work in general, if you went to my website, I do have a website, you're going to see that work is fairly different than what I made for this zoo project. And that just kind of, you know, shows you what commission work maybe is like versus, you know, when an artist is in his studio making the work that's very personal to them. So that work, again, will be very different. That actually was the challenge for me, and maybe one of the reasons why I have not done many commissions. I was so thankful that this project came along because one of my bucket list items was to do a public commission, you know, before I left the earth.
Well, and you've done that in spades with this. So why did you throw your hat into the ring for this? This was a national, even an international call for art and for designs.
Exactly.
We actually had people from Canada and Australia applying to have pieces in this project. So we're delighted that two of the artists that were selected are local artists. But why did you choose to throw your hat in the ring on this?
Well, it just seemed like, you know, having talked about it for years that, hey, I would love to do one of these commissions. Well, it was time to put up or shut up. And when it's in your own backyard, it's like there are no excuses. And so the challenge that I knew it would be really going out of my comfort zone and making work that I don't make, I knew that would be tough, but I said, I better give it a shot. This is my best shot at it. So I really, and I actually kind of waited near the end before I finally looked in the mirror and said, I better do this. So I proposed, you know, a linear sculpture. Again, I'm good at welding, so I figured, you know, go there. But I tell you, the tough part when I designed it was could I make this thing that really satisfied me and yet satisfied the community? And so that was the challenge. And I was surprisingly, it worked out great. I really enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed designing it. I like what I made. And I love the fact that I think it's going to do well with this project.
And I think our community will love it too. It's certainly big, but talk a little bit. It's one of the more contemporary designs.
Right.
And what does that mean to you? You are both a teacher as well as an artist. So with this piece, I feel like there's actually a kind of educational component in the way that you've designed it. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things I try to tell my students early on is that art is, people in general get an idea of what art is, and usually they're thinking one slice of a pie. That's the way I look at it, is the art world, there's more slices to the pie. So I try to talk to them about, you know, representational work and the history of that, and then I talk about abstraction and maybe the early 1900s of when, you know, when artists really started to abstract ideas. And then, you know, in the 1950s, we went to non-objective. That is where we don't have to really tie our art to things, to where it doesn't have to be a thing. I don't have to make, you know, an animal. I can just do line in space. Why can't line in space be an interesting thing in and of itself? So anyway, there's that educational component of trying to, you know, teach students about that, and certainly teach the public about that. I think, you know, what I try to tell the public is, you know, if you have a real narrow view of what you think art is, well, you're going to be disappointed probably 80% of the time, and you have to really open your mind and be aware of the different ways to approach it. And if you have an open mind, then you'll start to think about it, understand it more, and maybe be more accepting of it. So it was just a no-brainer for me to make an abstracted, linear version of a giraffe.
Love that. I think that, that's really, it's almost like this whole project is going to be like a walk through art history in some ways. And I want to get back to Tom also, and just as we wrap up, you get to see for yourself the impact that art has. Where there wasn't a piece of art, and then there is a piece of art in our public spaces. So, Tom, what role do you think art plays in our community?
In our community, I think it definitely, one of the things that it does is it kind of denotes these special places that are kind of, the community has collective ownership of and celebrates. It really helps signify these places that are special to everyone that we want to share. And so the impact of art in those spaces, I think, varies by the individual, but I think pretty universally it elicits excitement. I think one of the examples that comes to mind for me is the transformation of Indian Spring Park with Clifton's earlier project, Branding of the Brazos, mm-hmm. the Steers. It is one of the most heavily photographed places in our community. And, you know, that's endured through the Magnolia era for a reason, because people go there, this great public open space that is punctuated by these stimulating, larger-than-life sculptures. And they just want to celebrate that moment and remember it. And so that's one example of how people engage art in public spaces. But I think it speaks to some of the themes that art plays in all of our public spaces.
And Robbie, what role do you think art plays in our community? I know this is something you think about a lot.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I agree with all that. I would just expand it and say, it's not just, actual art pieces in the community. Art is all around us. I think that's the thing I try to remind people, that, the clothes you're wearing, the shoes you're wearing, the cars you drive, the glasses on your face, the cups you use, art is such an integrated part of our lives that a lot of times we just don't realize that. And so I try to, when I talk to the community, people in the community, I just try to get them to understand that, we don't just sort of turn it on or off, we're going to make art for this project. It's like we're making art every day, and we're making aesthetic decisions with everything that we do. So,
well, thank you very much to Tom Bulk and Robbie Barber for this conversation today. This has been Conversations with Creative Waco. I'm your host for today, Fiona Bond. You can find further information about this project, all the amazing people in our community who've been involved in it, from the donors to the artists to those who've helped install the work and those who've built plinths. It's really been a village effort. You can find further information about all those aspects of the project at creativewaco.org, and we will have a blog post that accompanies this program. We hope that you all have a very happy new year beginning to 2020, and we look forward to celebrating this project at the end of January when it should be completed. So thank you so much to Tom Bulk and Robbie Barber for being with me today.
Pleasure, Fiona. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Luann Jennings for talking about professional development for artists and creatives in our community, and to Tom Bulk and Robbie Barber for talking about the Waco Sculpture Zoo. It's been a real pleasure to sit in the host seat today, and I want to extend thanks to Ray Jefferson and Kennedy Sam, who are our usual hosts for Conversations with Creative Waco. We wish all of you a very happy start to the new year. 2020 is going to be full of great art opportunities in Waco, and we hope that one of your resolutions is to dive into all the great artistic and cultural offerings in our community.